This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Welcome to Musings from Greek 365, a podcast series of 8 episodes on Homer's Iliad, created by the students in advanced undergraduate Greek tours, taught by Professor Deborah Beck at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Austin McDowell, a student in the class, and this is episode 5, Priam's Supplication of Sunslaying Achilles. In the last episode, my classmate Claudia talked about the opening of book 23, discussing the funeral rites of Patroclus. In this episode, we will jump several hundred lines to the middle of book 24. I will be looking in depth at lines 477 to 486, but also touching upon events both before and after. In book 22, Hector met his violent end at the hands of Achilles, and now, as the Iliad comes to a close, we shall see the immediate aftermath of Troy losing his protector. In the earlier portions of book 24, Apollo convinces Zeus that Achilles must let the body of Hector, which he continues to defile, be ransomed back to Priam. To Achilles, Zeus sends Thetis, and to Priam, Zeus sends Iris, with the message to initiate the ransom. Priam sets out with the ransom and his charioteer, and is also joined by Hermes in the guise of a myrmidon, who guides Priam safely through the Achaean camp. Eventually, Priam enters the tents of Achilles, unnoticed, clasps his knees, and he kisses the terrible manslaying hands that have killed his many sons. Before Priam speaks in 486, however, Homer includes an interesting simile, which reads in English as follows. As when some cruel ruin has befallen a man that he has killed someone in his own country and must flee to a great man's protection in a land of foreigners, and all who see him marvel, even so did Achilles marvel as he beheld Priam. You may notice the seeming role reversal. Achilles is the killer, but it is Priam that seeks refuge. Achilles is also the foreigner in Priam's land, and while Achilles is great, the wealth of King Priam was legendary. Some scholars have already taken to referring to this as a reverse simile because of its nature. So then why include this particular situation for comparison? For most of the remainder of this episode, I shall be discussing 4 different theories. Its use for emphasis through the means of juxtaposition, allusions to Peleus in 2 different respects, and its importance as a landmark within a longer Catullus story. Relating a murderer seeking refuge immediately before an old man beseeches the killer of his sons certainly has an interesting effect. The action is the same, but the cause and purpose are totally contrasting. Frankel argues that interplay of polar opposites is a basic constituent of early Greek, and that was the way their brains were wired to think, constantly considering concepts in terms of entirely different situations. Porter compares it to constructions where war and peace are paired analogously, which renders the war scenes darker and the peace scenes brighter. Situating Priam in the role of the murderer emphasizes his harmlessness. Another suggestion is an allusion to Peleus as the host. Peleus took in several refugees. Phoenix nearly killed his father. Epagius and Patroclus were both homicides. This theory would paint Achilles and Priam both as similar to Achilles' father. Achilles for granting Priam his safety and Priam for absolving Achilles of the slaughter of Hector. In this instance, the audience to take on the role of Odysseus, Phoenix, and Nestor in Book 9, who all relayed the ethics of Peleus. Achilles needs guidance of his father all the time, only this time, no one is there to explicitly provide it. It is also suggested that the simile is an allusion to Peleus as a refugee in the situation. The lost epic Alcmaeonis told the story of how Peleus and Telamon murdered their brother Phocos. The later source, Pausanias, has Peleus sent into exile by his father, Niarchos. He then took refuge with and was purified by Eurytion of Phthia. Cruel fate, however, had Peleus commit a second homicide. He accidentally takes the life of Eurytion during the Caledonian boar hunt, upon which event Pindar claims he flees to court of Acastos, where he is again absolved of his crimes. In this situation, Priam is like Peleus. Achilles sees his father he will not be able to care for, something he already feels pain over. I think Priam's first line of speech really strengthens the argument for an allusion to Peleus. So close to the simile on murder refugees is the line, Nesai patros, soyo teos epikel akileu. The last suggestion I would like to look at is the section as part of a symbolic catabasis. Lines 349 to 353 read, Now when the two had driven past the great tomb of Ilus, they stayed their mules and horses to water them in the river. For by this time darkness had descended on the land, and the herald made out Hermes, who is coming toward them at a short distance. So this would be descent into the underworld. And line 692 to 695 read, But when they came to the crossing place of the fair-running river, of whirling Xanthus, a stream whose father was Zeus the immortal, there Hermes left them and went away to the height of Olympus. And Dawn, she of the yellow robe, scattered over all the earth, which has the exit in reverse. The river, the night, and Hermes' company are the three elements which mark the start of a journey and inversely its end. A river as a frontier, darkness, and the company of Hermes are the most recognizable features of his ascent into the underworld. Ilus's tomb is a permanent landmark in the Iliad, but the mention of a tomb just before crossing the boundary wholly agrees with the conceit of entering the realm of the dead. The river seems to function as a liminal zone between the realm of the living and that of the dead in other passages of the Iliad, a role we see reprised in this scene. Hermes' attributes as escort are repeatedly stressed. His sandals, the staff with which he makes the guardian sleep in lines 343 to 344 and 445 to 446, and his epithet, Diaktoros, is used both in lines 432 and 445. The journey also has its dangers. There's the locks on the gates, the risk of discovery by Achaeans, and the gatekeepers. The tent of Achilles even seems to be modeled after the House of Hades. Lines 448 through 456 describe it as a large dwelling with a roof, a courtyard, and bolted gates. 456 explains that the gates only Achilles himself can open, reminiscence of Hades' epithet, Boulartes, gate fastener, which is used in books 8 and 13 with regards to Heracles' catabasis. And earlier, Priam feels death and is soothed by Hermes. And despite all his fear, Priam succeeds in doing what no other mortal on the earth has yet done. When I led the class, I first had my classmates read the and translate lines 477 through 486, then ask them their thoughts on the simile with no further information. They seemed to like that I had done this, getting input from them without inserting my own conclusions or those of other scholars. It was interesting to see that they generally arrived at the same ideas. I did, however, learn that it's not easy to keep this in check. It's easy for such an interpretive discussion to run rampant. I'm not assertive, and I enjoyed hearing my classmates' thoughts. So I let the conversation go on unreined for quite some time. It was not an issue in this circumstance, but something I shall be noting for future teaching experience. One of my classmates pointed out that letting them speak without much guidance isn't very productive, and something I shall be taking into consideration. Keeping in mind that I am oftentimes the only one who has done the extra research. Overall, I do feel this was a really constructive experience for my teaching abilities. It reminded me that I either need to devote more time to actually memorizing everything I want to say, or to actually come prepared with an outline or note cards, as I am often reluctant to do. It was nice to receive positive feedback on the projection of my voice, my ability to gauge the class, and my use of movement. all things I've struggled with in the past. I'm happy to have had this experience, and I feel lucked out on the passage I used. It was really nice to discuss. It was really interesting. And I just feel it deserves to be considered among one of the great passages of literature of any period. Please feel free to leave comments or questions regarding either the topic material or the quality of my podcast. All of your feedback is appreciated by myself and Dr. Beck, as well as her future students. Please join us for episode 6, where my friend Rachel will continue the discussion of book 24 of Homer's Iliad.